Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Well, now the results of the presidential election in just 14 weeks from today, assuming no repeats of Florida 2000, and Donald Trump has said that he's afraid the election's going to be rigged. Donald Trump may be one of the most unlikely candidates for the presidency ever, which may be part of his appeal to some. Joining us now is Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist David K. Johnston, who's been reporting on Trump for almost 30 years. His latest book, The Making of Donald Trump, is published by Melville House, and I'm very pleased it has brought David K. Johnston back to our show. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me again. This is like 24 years after the first time.
Yesterday, President Obama said that Trump is unfit to serve as president. Has Trump responded directly to that?
I don't know. I've been so busy working on the book, I don't know. But I'm sure Donald, in his own mind, believes he would be the greatest president ever.
And I think he said that Obama has been a disaster. Are you aware of any other time when a president has made such a comment while still in office?
No. And I think one of the big things we're going to see over the next 14 weeks is what Republicans are going to do, and I'm a registered Republican, about Donald Trump. I said right after he announced in June of 2015 that he might get the nomination, and I said, if he does, it will be the end of the modern Republican Party as we know it, just as the Whigs went away in 1856.
When he says he's afraid the election's going to be rigged, is he trying to incite opposition in the event that he loses?
Well, he's trying to avoid having to acknowledge, if he doesn't win, that he's a loser.
Well, he told a supporter, don't abide by the results if I don't win.
Yeah. Donald has, in various ways, sought to stoke violence, racial enmity. He'll deny all of this, even as he does it. And it should be very deeply disturbing to us. You know, you and I grew up in the Cold War era. Imagine if in the 60s, 70s, 50s, a presidential candidate had suggested that a foreign power, particularly Moscow, hack some Americans' emails. The chorus would be overwhelming, not the silence.
Doesn't it come as a bit of a surprise in another way? Because he had such a good relationship with Roy Cohn, who was McCarthy's sidekick and the leading anti-communist in this country.
Yes, but Donald's relationship with Roy Cohn was about using Roy's mob clients, the heads of the Genovese and Gambino families, among others, to make him money by ensuring labor peace, by allowing him to hire non-union, illegal immigrant Polish workers at $4 an hour who worked alongside union workers. The ratio was about 10 Polish guys to 10 to one union worker, and other financial deals. That was his relationship with Roy as his mentor and sort of second father.
What about gambling? Because the mob has always been involved with gambling. In fact, the mob made Las Vegas.
Well, I came to Atlantic City in 1988 where I met Donald Trump because I believed we were going to see the third wave of gambling in America. It would spread across the country, which it did, and I met him right away. And I wanted to write about, did the state of New Jersey really successfully regulate to keep the mob out? They did a very good job in a lot of ways, but in the case of Donald Trump, they failed to fully investigate him. He only had a 5-month investigation. He had been the subject of 4 different grand jury investigations that he concealed right until the last moment, which should have disqualified him. And once he was licensed, his relationships with a major drug trafficker he sought leniency for, his relationships with various mobsters came to light, his cheating in one of the empty box scandals, the Bulgari one where you send an empty box out of state to evade the state income tax, came to light. The state of New Jersey's Division of Gaming Enforcement made sure it never asked a question that would force them to recommend the removal of Donald's license. They were just masterful at avoiding the obvious question in the room. And I The first time I was on your show, I wrote a book about that. Well, there were two things going on. One is, remember, New Jersey has the most powerful governor in America by far. The Division of Gaming Enforcement to have gone after Donald's license for a number of things would have meant they would have to admit that they messed up the first time. And the bureaucratic imperative always is you didn't do anything wrong as a bureaucracy.
But he confused Tim Kaine with the former governor of New Jersey, Tom Kaine. Tom Kaine didn't have a good relationship with him?
He had some relationship with him, but I don't like gaffes. I don't like going after politicians because you missaid something. I've missaid things watched on the tape later on TV and gone, oh, no, wrong word.
But Donald but confusing
didn't, Donald didn't
two
do it just
governors.
Once. Yes. He said Tim Kaine, he confused Virginia and New Jersey, and Tom Kaine and Tom Kaine, who are very different in age. And that goes to something very important voters need to understand about Donald. Donald is in no way a serious person. He doesn't know anything. And in the book, I cite examples from testimony where he gives answers that make it clear he has no idea the things that he talks about. They're gibberish, his answers.
How much of the past 20 years or so has Trump been as much an entertainment figure as a developer?
Oh, he's hardly done any development in years. And people who bought into a number of Trump buildings in Hawaii, Baja California, Florida, who thought that Donald Trump was the developer, they got statements either calling him the builder or the developer. He did promotional videos. People follow me because I'm Donald Trump and they know what great buildings I do, and that said developer Donald Trump. They found out later that he was simply a licensee of his name. And in one case, the Hawaii case, there had to be renewals of the right to use his name, and he could have just snatched it away with no reason and built a building next door calling it Trump, which would reduce the value of your investment. We have a word to describe that kind of stuff: fraud. Civil fraud.
Now, he has complained about how the media have written about him, but have the news media missed important elements of his story?
Yeah, Leonard, I have been from the get-go critical of the coverage of Donald Trump. I wrote a piece for the National Memo last July, 21 questions for Donald Trump for journalists to ask him. Two of them were eventually asked, one by Marco Rubio and the other by Ted Cruz, but journalists are not asking him the tough questions, and they're not following up, with some rare exceptions. The other day when he suggested that the Russians hack Hillary Clinton's email, Katie Tour of MSNBC got right on him and said, "Are you serious?" And then again said, "Are you sure? Doesn't this give you pause?" The next day, Trump goes, "I was being sarcastic." So what are all the news accounts that follow? Trump said he was being sarcastic. You don't get to double and triple down that you're serious, and then when you get in trouble for it, wipe it away by saying it was a joke.
You say that you met him first because of Atlantic City.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first impression of him?
P.T. Barnum. I had met the modern P.T. Barnum, and he was selling us the Fiji Mermaid. But there was something about him that seemed a little bit off, and I didn't know what it was. And I began interviewing people in Atlantic City, both other casino executives, Steve Wynn, a serious, successful casino operator, and some of Trump's own people, and fellow journalists. And they all started telling me, Donald doesn't know anything about the casino business. All he knows how to do is to extract money. And so one of the first times we met, I did something investigative reporters often do. I made an untrue statement to him while asking a question. He immediately incorporated the falsehood into his answer and tried to run with it. That's what these fake psychics you see advertised on daytime TV and con artists do.
And Marco Rubio called him a con artist.
Yes, I think he is. I think that he is essentially a con artist who has spent his entire adult life associating with, doing business with, and going to bat for con artists, swindlers, mob associates, mobsters, and this major cocaine trafficker.
We'll get to that major cocaine trafficker in just a second. My guest is David K. Johnston. The Making of Donald Trump is his latest book. Why would he even have anything to do with a major cocaine trafficker?
Well, this guy, Joseph Wechselbaum, a convicted felon, had a helicopter business, and he maintained Donald's personal helicopter, the Ivana, and he maintained his fleet of helicopters for his Atlantic City casinos. And Wechselbaum ran a drug smuggling operation that went from the Miami, Florida area to Cincinnati. He was indicted. The court record shows that he personally handled the drugs and often put them in vehicles, and he said shipments of up to 1,500 pounds that are in the indictment. God, who knows how big they may have been. He asked that his case be transferred when he was going to plead guilty either to Miami, where it originated, or New York City, where he lived, and instead, mysteriously, it went to New Jersey, where it came before a federal judge named Marianne Trump Berry, his sister. Now, she recused herself from the case, but you think about it. Imagine you're the chief judge, and one of your judges walks into your relatively newly appointed judge and says, you know, I have to get myself out of this case because my husband, who's a lawyer for Donald Trump, flies in this man's helicopters. I fly in his helicopters many times, have flown in them. Imagine the potential disaster for the federal judiciary that it's got a sitting federal judge flying around in helicopters from a drug dealer. Well, the little fish in this case, they got up to 20 years. What did Joe Wechselbaum get after Donald Trump wrote a letter pleading for mercy for him and saying he's a stand-up guy? He got 18 months. He served 18 months. He got 3 years.
From your description of Trump's father and grandfather, it sounds like con artistry might run in the family.
Yes. Donald's grandfather, when he turned 16 and faced mandatory military service in Germany, left in the middle of the night and came to the United States. He followed Horace Greeley's advice and went west. And in Seattle, Everett, Washington, and the Yukon Territory, he ran whorehouses, made a fortune, came back to Germany, married a young woman over his mother's objections, came to New York. They had a baby girl. She hated New York. He went back to Germany, and the Germans said, "We don't care how much money you brought with you, pal. You dodged the draft. Get out of Germany." He died in the influenza pandemic in 1918 when his only son, Fred, was a teenager. 2 years after his death, Fred and his mother had a business, and a very industrious guy, Fred Trump. He was building, as a teenager, garages for these newfangled thing called automobiles. He built, started building houses in the 20s when the economy collapsed in 1929. He was innovative and started one of the first groceries where you pull your own stuff off the shelf, which reduced the labor costs and quickly sold that for a bit of money. And then when World War II came along, he built military housing for civilian workers for the military. And after the war, was reportedly the first person in line at the Federal Housing Administration to get loans to build housing for GIs.
It's also been reported that he was arrested at a KKK rally in 1927. Has that ever been confirmed?
Oh, absolutely. Donald has said, you shouldn't write about this. It really didn't happen. My father wasn't charged. So even if it did happen, you know, that he was no charge, you shouldn't write about it. The fact is that all the newspapers that reported on it at the time gave the same address. It is the address that public records show was occupied by his father, Fred Trump, even though Donald said, my father never lived at that address. He was not charged, nor were most of the other people. The police arrested him and made a record, and then the city didn't prosecute them.
However vile Fred Trump's views might have been, what relevance do they have now?
Well, because Donald has followed through in those approaches. There was rampant discrimination against blacks and Puerto Ricans in many of the Trump buildings. They had certain buildings where they would steer people. And in 1972, the federal government sent out housing test teams. So they would have a black person or couple go out, and they would have a story and documentation on their finances, they're employed, they qualified. If they were told there was no apartment or they were steered to one of these buildings, a white tester with the exact same financial information would show up, and they'd be told, oh, we have lovely apartments for you. Would you like this one or this one or this one? When the federal government, under the Housing Act that was passed just days after Martin Luther King's assassination, came after them, Roy Cohn drafted a lawsuit attacking the federal government, and Donald said they're trying to force us to put people on welfare in our buildings. Lawsuit had nothing to do with welfare. It had to do with flat-out racial discrimination. If I can just finish this point, Leonard, for 2 years they were under supervision. They behaved perfectly. The supervision ended. The government sent out new teams. Guess what? They went right back to discriminating against blacks and Puerto Ricans.
Didn't Woody Guthrie even mention Trump in a variation of one of his songs?
He wrote a song, and the Guthrie family, bless their souls, made it possible for me to have the lyrics in my book, The Making of Donald Trump.
And the book is called The Making of Donald Trump by David K. Johnston, formerly of The New York Times, winner of the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for Journalism, now teaching at Syracuse University College of Law. and sued by Donald Trump how many times?
Oh, haven't ever been sued. Donald did call me in April, and it was the typical Donald call I've gotten at home in the past. Hail fellow, well met, seeking a little information, romance, how, you know, I like you, menace, I'm going to sue you, and click.
The book is published by Melville House. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with David K. Johnston, whose latest book is The Making of Donald Trump. It is published by Melville House. Before he announced his presidential campaign, how much about political or business experience did he have? Did it amount to more than making headlines?
Well, Donald has more than 500 business entities, partnerships, licensing of his name.
So he has clout.
Well, he has a lot of business entities. he certainly has political clout. I mean, Donald's father's best friend was Abe Beame. And when Abe Beame was mayor, as the Libby Handros documentary Donald suppressed called Trump the Movie, or, and if I have the name wrong, forgive me, there's a city official who says, Mayor Beame says, whatever Donald Trump wants, he gets in the city. And, of course, he got a $400 million tax break. Donald's one of the biggest welfare recipients in America.
When did he first hint at a desire for elective office?
1985.
Had his father ever considered it?
Not that I know of. His father had some showmanship. When he destroyed the steeplechase ride at Coney Island, he hired women in what in the day were pretty scandalous pink bikinis to hand out bricks so people could throw them at the clown face and destroy it. But Donald, in 1988, proposed that he be George H.W. Bush's running mate. In 2000, he ran on the Reform Party ticket and bragged he'd be the first person ever to make a profit. And then when he ran in 2012, everybody treated this seriously except Lawrence O'Donnell and I, who separately realized he was negotiating a better contract with NBC.
Christopher Buckley wrote an acceptance speech, a presidential acceptance speech for Donald Trump in the year 2000 that was published in the Wall Street Journal. And he really captures the spirit of Donald Trump's speech, even though the sentences are too complete. But it is quite hilarious. So there was serious talk about him perhaps running for president at that point.
Well, yes. And by the way, I wrote my weekly column for the Daily Beast. I wrote a speech for Donald and said, this is the speech that could get you elected, mm-hmm. which is put out your tax returns. They're going to show you paid no taxes. And then you say to the public, this is an outrage. And lots of very, very wealthy people, billionaires like me, not necessarily that he's a billionaire, don't pay income taxes because of special rules you've never heard of, unless you read David K. Johnston's books. And this is awful. And elect me, and you know what? People like me are going to pay taxes, and you're going to pay less. And he could probably get elected with that speech.
Donald Trump, Michael Bloomberg, Mitt Romney, Meg Whitman, Carly Fiorina, in the past, Nelson Rockefeller. What is it about business executives and elected office?
I don't think Donald fits the same pattern as these other people. There certainly is a lot of ego. Anybody wants to run for president of the United States has to have a pretty big ego. But in Donald's case, you have to understand that in his own mind, Donald is the greatest person around. And either you respect and glory in Donald's greatness and worship it, or he has a word for you. Loser. Mm.
You wrote about how the wealthy enrich themselves at our expense in your book, Free Lunch. Is Trump blowing the cover?
Not really, because he doesn't say anything substantive about stuff. If you listen to Donald carefully, you'll notice that he talks like a con artist, a huckster. He doesn't really say anything specific. And if he gets in trouble for what he does, he just says, I didn't really mean to say that. Or he denies that he said it, even though, you know, who are you going to believe, your lying ears and eyes or Donald Trump?
How does his record in business compare with that of some of the other super rich who have run for office? Because they've all run on the idea that they can run government in the same efficient way they've run their businesses.
Well, of course, we don't want government run like business. First of all, we want it to be accountable. But Donald was evaluated by Fortune magazine some years ago, along with 495 other publicly traded companies when he had his casino company. Donald came in either dead last or nearly last in every category, quality of management, return on assets, turnover, et cetera. And in his
he's
own
declared bankruptcy several times.
He has never
Should
declared
bankruptcy. He hasn't?
No. the casino company he founded went through, while he was there, four bankruptcies, in each of which he extracted millions of dollars while stiffing vendors. The residue that was left, there were two more bankruptcies that flowed out of Donald's utter mismanagement. And Donald, by the way, also has a history of firing the most competent executives and replacing them with yes men, and in at least one case, falling down drunks.
There are a number of wealthy business people who have declared, in many cases Republicans, who have declared that they're going to, they're endorsing Hillary Clinton. And on Monday, Warren Buffett challenged Trump to discuss tax returns. What do we know about his history on taxes, either personally or through his companies?
Well, we know, and I reported this in my first book when you had me on 24 years ago, Temples of Chance, about casinos, that Donald paid ordinary income taxes for the few years after he graduated from college. And then in 1978, his income went negative, and he paid no income taxes. He paid none in 1979. And we know that he paid no taxes in 92 and 94. He probably has paid no income taxes in decades, or maybe 1 or 2 years. But the most important year was 1984. That was the year that Donald's income exploded. Trump Tower opened in December and the early of 83 and the early part of 84, huge cash flow. His first casino opened just before the summer gambling season in Atlantic City. And yet Donald filed with the state of New York and the city of New York what are called Schedule C tax returns, so what freelancers, independent sole proprietors file. Zero income, over $600,000 in losses. He was asked to substantiate them. Couldn't do it. He ordered his tax lawyer and accountant, Jack Mitnick, to file appeals. There were trials held. In the city trial, Jack Mitnick was shown the only tax return anybody could find, which was a photocopy. Nobody could find the original. And he looked at it and said, well, that's my signature, but neither I nor my staff prepared that tax return. And the judge in that case and the state case both said, you know, this is just bizarre. Why there weren't further proceedings, I don't know. It also came out in one of these cases that Donald paid no federal income tax that year. So we know for an absolute certainty of at least 5 years since 78 with none. But in all likelihood, because of a variety of circumstances I read about in the book, he has probably not paid income taxes in years.
Mitt Romney also worked to keep his income taxes concealed. But when they were revealed, it hurt him in the election. Donald Trump has said he could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and it wouldn't hurt him.
I think saying you could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue should hurt a lot. Mitt Romney withheld from us the returns that I think he should have released when he was the sole owner. He wasn't just the manager, but the sole owner of Bain Capital Management. Special federal tax rules, and that's what I teach at Syracuse University is tax law, allowed him to live tax-free. And in all likelihood, he did. That's why I suspected we'd never see his returns.
Bloomberg Businessweek recently reported on possible violations of U.S. trade embargo on in Cuba by the Trump Organization. Have you followed that at all?
Well, I mentioned it in one of my columns. It came out after my book. Donald's golfing enterprise has repeatedly sent people down to Cuba hoping to make a deal. And without – you can go to Cuba, but you have to get proper authorizations to do so, and you can't engage in trade. Understand that Donald is a man whose entire life he has flouted the law and gotten away with it. Well, why would you behave any differently because you're running for president if your life experience is that you actually get rewarded and make money for not obeying the law?
The Justice Department sued him in 1973. What was that about?
That was the housing material we talked about earlier where he claimed that it was a welfare issue when it was not.
NPR reported yesterday that some former Justice Department officials worried that President Trump might interfere with law enforcement. Hasn't the Trump Organization had confrontations with law enforcement in the past?
Yeah, one of Donald's greatest skills, and I admire Donald for this in a strange way, is deflecting, shutting down law enforcement investigations, many of them, and I describe a number of them in the book, journalistic investigations and litigation by others. And he's really very masterful at recognizing when the game is up and figuring out how to somehow shut off the investigation before it ruins what he's up to.
My guest is David J. Johnston, David K. Johnston, C-A-Y. His latest book, The Making of Donald Trump, published by Melville House. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A listener has called in to ask how you'd respond to Trump supporters who dismiss factual accounts as liberal propaganda.
Well, yeah, for 40 years in this country, we've had a well-funded campaign to attack journalists who do honest work. And my answer to that would be, I use Donald's own words, his sworn testimony, his writings, his speeches, his interviews. In the back of the book, I not only have very extensive endnotes, but I give you my personal email. If you can't find one of these documents or you want something more, I'll put my time into showing you. But it is really damaging to a democracy that we have people who believe that these various disreputable and well-documented promoters of fake news and falsehoods and who gin up huge stories, and then if something happens, they have to get away with it. We'll make, you know, one disclosure at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on TV or in the back pages. Are have credibility with people? They shouldn't. And you know, verification is the first step in journalism. I've lectured on four continents. I'm the former head of Investigative Reporters and Editors, my professional association, about the most fundamental job as a journalist is check it out. If your mother says she loves you, check it out. But then you have to cross-check and cross-check and cross-check until you have bolted the facts down and you've put them in their proper place in the universe. So you're not turning, you're not taking shotguns to a gnat.
After Clint Eastwood's rather confused chat with a chair in 2012, a Republican official said something like, "He's Clint Eastwood. You don't question him." How does Trump take advice or feedback? And does he ever admit mistakes or apologize?
Well, in the first part, the only person who appears to have influence with Donald is his daughter, Ivanka. I haven't seen them interact, but he has said things, and we've seen things happen, and other people have talked about that she has at times gotten him to tone it back. Nobody else has any influence on his thinking, and I've interviewed a number of his former executives and lawyers who've jousted with him, and they all are consistent that Donald does what he wants to do. That was the second part to your question that was very important, Leonard. I'm sorry.
The second part was, does he ever make mistakes?
Oh,
yes. To making mistakes. Does he ever apologize?
Does
he think he ever makes mistakes?
Yes. Donald, who goes around saying that I'm a Christian and no one reads the Bible more than Donald Trump, even though he can't cite accurately anything in the Bible, has also said, well, no, I've never asked God for forgiveness. I've never done anything asking for forgiveness that would require it. I've never done anything wrong. That is an astonishing statement for someone who says they're a Christian.
And we have seen some of that with the whole matter of sacrifice and then this Purple Heart incident. A veteran gave Trump his Purple Heart yesterday. Don't the very voters who most support the military also support Donald?
Well, you'll notice that the big dog, the American Legion, has been silent about this, which I'm the son of a 100% disabled veteran of World War II who went to college on the GI Bill's War Orphans Act provisions. And I will acknowledge in this case, I'm offended by his remarks about this. But I'm shocked that we haven't seen the American Legion, like the Veterans of Foreign Wars and other groups, step forward about this, particularly when Donald has said in the past, well, I really did serve in the military, because he was sent to a military academy by his father because he was a troublemaker and what was called back when you and I were in school, maladjusted. But that also goes to the fact that Donald doesn't know anything. I have three questions I've written down for Donald and three for Hillary. And if one of the TV networks were to put me on to debate, they're short, brief questions. His are really easy. Hers are really tough. And I'm
sure to share
them
with us?
No, when the election's over. I will post them on my eponymous website when the election's over, because the point is to ask them out of the blue. And Hillary's these are tough questions. His are really soft, and I don't think he can answer them.
Well, we saw a really odd response to George Stephanopoulos when they talked a bit about the annexation of Crimea and what's going on in the Ukraine.
If Donald were on a TV show and the host were to suddenly on the green screen behind them throw up a map of the world and say, Donald, just where's Crimea? With nothing on the map, just the outlines of even countries. I doubt that Donald could find Crimea.
This is not the first candidate who would have those problems.
Was
there similar things said about George W. Bush?
But the difference here is that Donald tells you that he is all-knowing and all-wise. Donald says, I know more about ISIS, whose correct name is ISIL, than the generals do. Donald creates his own reality. He just makes stuff up. And what I do in the book is take his own words and show you who he is and what he's done, along the line of F. Scott Fitzgerald's famous observation in The Last Tycoon, action is character. Here's what he said. Here's what he did. What does that tell you about him? And then draw your own conclusions. You want to vote for him after that? Fine. But know who you're voting for.
The New York State, you talked earlier about that whole business with the Bulgari, shipping empty boxes to Roy Cohn's home in Connecticut. Weren't fake shipments out of state for valuable purchases fairly common?
Oh, they still are. There's a current case going on right now. This is a continuing scandal involving the big jewelers in New York. But what's different about Donald is that when this story didn't appear on the front page of the New York Times or the Daily News or the Post, it appeared in the Village Voice. One of Wayne Barrett's acolytes he was training, Bill Bastone, broke the story. And when Donald found out the investigation was underway, he did what he often does. Henry Kissinger did this, you know, Mary Tyler Moore did it. Donald ran to law enforcement and offered to rat out other people. And, of course, if he had been indicted in that case, he would have lost his casino license. Mayor Ed Koch, who Donald denigrates all the time, when the prosecution was finished of the owner, who's an Italian, and the store manager, said, this is an outrage. The customers should go to jail. 15 days will do the trick, but the customers, because that'll stop this bad practice.
Some have raised concerns about how the elite are treated differently under the law. Didn't you touch on that in Free Lunch?
In all my books.
So we see photos of Trump with Bill and Hillary Clinton, Michael Bloomberg, Ed Koch, and others. Was he on good terms with all of them at one point or another?
Sure. And when it was convenient for Donald, he was on good terms with anybody he wanted to be. He has funneled money to people. I tell about how his charitable foundation made a political contribution to the Attorney General of Florida, who shut down her investigation of Trump University. He should lose the charitable status of his foundation for this, particularly because they engaged in what I think was a scheme to hide what they really did. And, of course, law enforcement will often look the other way if you acknowledge what you did wrong, or they'll give you a slap on the wrist. You start lying to a federal agent, even if you're not under oath, that's a crime.
Everything you've said, although you've given us more detail in some cases, has been discussed in the past, and every day seems to bring a new revelation. We hear the latest also about how he got out of the draft. And yet it doesn't seem to have had much of an impact on the people who are
right.
who are wearing shirts with his image on them.
So I would suggest, Leonard, that there are two groups of people who are really supporting Donald Trump. One of them are the people whom I have been trying to champion for more than 20 years, the bottom 90% of Americans whose incomes adjusted for inflation last year were essentially the same as they were in 1967, the year I finished high school. The rules of our economy have been taking subtly from the many to give to the already rich few. That's what Free Lunch particular was about, of my books. And these people don't understand what's happened to them unless they've read my books, and they are looking for an answer. And Donald, like all demagogues, has provided a simple answer. The second thing, though, is that Donald's entire campaign is predicated on racism and xenophobia. The parents of the dead United States Army captain killed in combat. Donald, instead of saying, I respect your son, says, Islamic terrorism. Outrageous thing for him.
Suggested that they are connected to the Muslim Brotherhood.
Oh, yes. And that's because, I'm not going to make any bones about it, Donald is a racist. His conduct shows that he is a racist. He says he's not. It doesn't matter what you say. It is your conduct that matters. And Donald's record is very clear here.
David K. Johnson is an investigative journalist, winner of the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for Journalism, who's with the New York Times for a long time, and also is the former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors, currently teaching at Syracuse University College of Law. His latest book, The Making of Donald Trump, is published by Melville House. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Leonard, thank you.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Republican and Democratic National Conventions have come to an end, and so too must our series, Also-Rans, a look at American losers. Over the past 5 weeks, we've met a number of fascinating and influential characters who almost made it to the White House, and today we're going to focus on one of the newest members of that club, Senator Bernie Sanders. Although he lost the Democratic nomination for president, his campaign, his coalition, and his surprisingly strong funding network may prove invaluable to the future of the Democratic Party. Joining us to discuss that is former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich. Time magazine has named him one of the 10 most effective cabinet secretaries of the 20th century. He's a professor at UC Berkeley, the author of 14 books, including his most recent, Saving Capitalism, and he's the co-creator of the award-winning documentary Inequality for All. It is my great pleasure to welcome him back to our show to close out this series. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm well. I hope you are as well.
Yes, although, you know, it's been a bruising campaign season already, and I can't imagine how we're going to get through the next 3 months.
Well, we'll probably get through it the way we've gotten through some other really terrible times in this country. Have you spoken to Bernie Sanders recently?
Yes, I talked to him yesterday.
And did he tell you what's next on his agenda? Is he just going to go back to Congress?
No, we talked a little bit about it, and it's up to him to talk to the public about what is next on his agenda. But undoubtedly, he changed America, I think, for the better. I think his candidacy will be remembered as putting some major issues on the table, legitimizing some very, very important things that we as Americans ought to be aiming for, and also proving that you don't have to have a giant fundraising machine. You can actually rely on small contributions if you stand for something.
If the Democrats take back the Senate, do you think he might get a leadership role now that he's actually a member of the party?
Well, I think he should. You know, that he, by coming out as he did, as courageously as he did, against the Democratic and Washington establishment, he may have ruffled some feathers. I'm not sure that he's the most popular man in the Senate. But on the other hand, the Senate is ideally, that certainly the Democratic Senate is responsive to voters, is conscious of the fact that Bernie Sanders won 22 states and 13 million votes, and so they would be wise to give him a very important leadership position.
You've said that if Hillary Clinton won the nomination, you would do everything you could to get her elected. Is that your effective endorsement, or will you make a more formal announcement, and will you be stumping for her?
Well, I've already started stumping for her, and I am doing everything I can. I did endorse Bernie Sanders in the primaries, and at that time I said that I thought Hillary Clinton would be an excellent president for the system we have, but I was endorsing Bernie Sanders because I thought Bernie was important for the system we need. Well, Bernie did not get the nomination, but I still feel that Hillary Clinton will be an excellent president, and quite frankly, Leonard, I am very, very fearful, as many people are, of her opponent. I mean, the reason I'm diving into supporting her is not just because of fear. It's also my hope and expectation that she will do a very, very good job, if not a great job, as president. But I've got to tell you, I've never encountered in all of my years in and around politics, and those are many years, I've never encountered the nominee of a major party who is less qualified temperamentally and by what he has said and what he has done than Donald Trump.
Now, I'm curious about all of those little demurs that you have. You've known the Clintons for a long time. You met Hillary Clinton as an undergraduate, and doesn't she say that you went out on a date?
Well, it wasn't exactly a date. As my memory serves, we had she was president of her freshman class, I believe, at Wellesley. I was president of my sophomore class, and we had a kind of presidential summit meeting, I suggested. I had forgotten all about it until a reporter from the New York Times in 2008, when she was running for the presidency, or at least for the nomination for the presidency, for the Democratic nomination, called me and said that they had found a collection of her letters from her undergraduate days, and she mentions going out on a date with me. And the reporter asked if I can remember anything from that date that might shed light on how she would perform as a president.
That was
presumptuous. I said with my tongue firmly planted in my cheek, well, I remembered we went to a movie and she wanted a lot of butter on her popcorn. And then there was a silence, and I thought he had hung up. But actually, I said, are you still there? He said, I'm just writing all this down.
You met Bill Clinton when you were both Rhodes Scholars at Oxford, and then you knew both of them together at Yale Law School. You served as President Clinton's Secretary of Labor, and yet this is the second time that you've chosen to endorse Hillary Clinton's opponent in a Democratic primary. Were you always uncomfortable with their more moderate brand of liberalism, or have you just drifted away?
That's much too sweeping a statement. I mean, I endorse Barack Obama because I think that in 2008 he was saying things and standing for ideas and principles that I felt more compelling than Hillary Clinton. And I endorse Bernie Sanders this time for much the same reason, although this time around I think Bernie Sanders was saying and standing for things that I have written about and stumped for and been quite passionately engaged in, such as getting big money out of politics and having a single-payer health care plan and all of these things that we must, as a nation, move on toward, too. I have a great deal of faith in Hillary Clinton. I've worked very closely with her. But in those two instances, I thought her opponents were superior.
You wrote an article the other day beginning with the words, "Excuse me while I vomit," when you were describing the amount of special interests represented at the DNC in Philadelphia.
Isn't that awful? I mean, you know, if the Democrats are trying to show the public that they are not in the grip of the moneyed interests, they should have done, in my humble opinion, a much better job keeping Wall Street and big corporations at bay in Philadelphia. Now, obviously, Wall Street and big corporations have a First Amendment right to do and say what they want. But the Democrats gave them skyboxes and entertained them. And I just think that sends the wrong signal.
Now, you have also promoted the idea of a new progressive third party to be formed after the election is over. There have been attempts in the past, but do you think that somebody like Bernie Sanders would be amenable to that?
I don't know, quite frankly, but I do think it important to keep pressure on the Democrats, regardless of whether Hillary Clinton becomes president, especially if she does, but even if she's not, to keep pressure on the Democrats to do the right thing. The platform that the Democrats came up with, I thought, was a remarkably good platform, but platforms are easy. You know, words are easy.
Does anybody ever abide by a platform?
Well, they did in 1901, they did in 1933 to some extent, but very, very rarely. That's what I mean by words being cheap. Nothing good happens in Washington, in my experience, Leonard, unless good people outside Washington are mobilized and organized and energized to force good things to happen in Washington. So this is a more general comment. I think that we are in need of a third force, whether you call it an association or a party. I know that there is a Green Party out there, and I know there's a Libertarian Party, and there are a lot of other small splinter parties. But I'm talking about carrying on Bernie's message and keeping the heat on the Democrats. Now, before the election and before Election Day, I don't want to do that. I don't want to create any condition that increases the odds that Donald Trump will be president. But I think after Election Day, it is important for Bernie Sanders supporters and independents and even Republicans who feel that we've got to get big money out of politics to join together and demand that be the case.
Have you seen Alexander Pelosi's documentary in which he talks to some of the big money contributors to both parties?
Yes, I have, and it's disturbing. It's not news to me. I mean, the big money contributors are doing what they have always done, but they're doing more of it over the last three election cycles than they ever did before. And it's not just big individual contributors, obviously. It's also big corporations. It's Wall Street banks. And the fact of the matter is that in Washington, you're not going to bite the hands that feed you. You're going to listen to them. You're going to give them at least access. But access means you're going to listen to their lobbyists. You're going to give them an audience. You're going to allow them to have the last word. And very often that makes the difference in policymaking.
Campaign finance reform is on the Democratic platform, but is it possible if Congress continues to stymie any attempt to change it?
No, I don't think you can reform the system from the inside, which is why I think we need this third force or third party that really is dedicated to getting big money out of politics, reforming not only our democracy, but also at the same time supporting policies and candidates at all levels who will reverse our trend toward widening inequality, which really is the other side of the same coin. Because as Louis Brandeis, the great justice, said, we can have a democracy in this country, or we can have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both.
There's a tradition in this country of protest candidates, people who run just to get certain issues discussed and put into the national conversation. Do you think that's how Bernie Sanders saw his campaign at first? Do you think he ever imagined that he might get as close to winning as he actually did?
Well, my assumption, and I've talked to him quite a lot during the campaign, is that he really did view his candidacy initially as the way you defined a protest candidate, that is, putting issues on the table. I don't think he knew the extent of the pent-up demand for the message that he was providing. I think the campaign that he waged was not really about him so much as it was about that message. He'd be the first to admit it. And it took off, obviously. And it's not just the 22 states and the 13 million votes. It's also the fact that a majority of young people voted for him. A majority of people under the age of 30 provided more votes for Bernie Sanders than for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump put together. A huge number. I mean, he had most people under 45 in most states. And that, I think, bodes well for the future. I'm always looking for ways of being optimistic about the future, because there's so many signals and there's so many reasons to be less than optimistic. But one optimistic thing is that we have young people, and if you define people under 45 as young, certainly under 30, who really do have a very different vision of what this nation can be.
Aren't young voters notorious for not showing up on Election Day?
Well, that's always a problem with young voters. But we also know that the political attitudes people have and form between the ages of 18 and 28 follow them, generally speaking, not in every case, but generally follow them for their entire lifetimes. So if you're trying to predict how Americans are going to vote and what the dominant political culture is going to be in America over the next 25 or 30 years, you have a pretty good idea by looking at who those Bernie Sanders voters were.
Donald Trump has been openly courting Bernie or bust voters. Do you think that some of them might be tempted to vote for him?
Well, I certainly hope not. Yes, he's been courting them, but he is a faux, fake populist. I mean, Donald Trump, you just look at his history, his record, what he's actually saying. I mean, there's so much pomp and negativity and megalomania and bigotry and xenophobia. I can't imagine any Bernie Sanders supporter taking him seriously.
I'm speaking with Robert Reich. He is participating in our Also Rans look at American Losers series that we've been running this month. And today we're looking at Bernie Sanders. Do you think that he was hurt by the fact that he only switched to the Democratic Party recently?
I think actually that may have helped him, Leonard, because there's so many people out there who are so fed up with the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and politics as usual. You know, 42% of Americans describe themselves as independents. They're not even registered Democrats or Republicans. A large number of Americans just say to pollsters that they want fundamental change, and a majority wants big money out of politics. This is not just Democrats. You know, I on my recent book tour, I went to places that are strongholds of Republicans and Tea Partiers. And I would say to audiences, you know, how many of you describe yourselves as an independent Republican or independent conservative or a Tea Partier? Majority of hands would go up in the air. And then they would tell me that their number one priority is to end what they describe as crony capitalism, which is big money directing the show, big money having enough power to get corporate welfare and to get all the bailouts and special breaks for the wealthy and for big corporations. This is not just a Democratic capital D issue. This is a broad-based issue. Getting big money out of politics is something that I think we can do if people are active and if we create a broad coalition that goes across right and left and multi-ethnic and multi-racial lines. It's in all of our interests.
But hasn't it been discovered that some big money interests like the Koch brothers have bankrolled the Tea Party?
Well, yes.
Are members of the Tea Party aware of that?
Well, they aren't all that aware. I mean, the Koch brothers have done it very surreptitiously. They bankrolled a lot of people who pretend to be leaders of the Tea Party. But at the grassroots, most people who describe themselves as Tea Partiers, at least those I ran into on my book tour, through, you know, Missouri and Kansas and Louisiana and elsewhere, where I don't normally sell books. In fact, I doubt I sold any books there anyway. Most of those people really are anti-politics as usual. They don't consider themselves under the thumb of any big money interest, and they show quite a lot of contempt for the Koch brothers.
Bernie Sanders has called himself a social democrat, although a number of socialists would argue that he isn't really. Has the connotation of the word socialist changed as a result of his campaign?
Well, it certainly has changed in the sense that younger people who don't remember America before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and believe it or not, there are many young people who don't. They don't have the same reaction to the word socialism that many of the rest of us do, who grew up with the great menace of Soviet communism. I even remember, you know, the Joe McCarthy witch hunts. Well, young people today look at the word socialism, and according to polls, a majority of young people actually like that word better than the word capitalism, believe it or not. But I think Bernie also contributed to a public understanding. Even people who were either indifferent or slightly nervous about the word socialism saw and were educated by Bernie a different model, a democratic socialism, much more akin to what Europe has accomplished, and particularly Northern Europe, which has elements that are very attractive for the United States. We could never actually directly emulate Northern Europe, but certainly in some respects, such as single-party and single-payer health care plan, we can do well by following Northern Europe's example.
Many of the policies proposed by socialists like Eugene V. Debs and Norman Thomas have become part of the American body politic, and our the New Deal was also and all sorts of union laws adopted things they proposed. The first black candidates, Clifton DeBerry and others, were on the Socialist Party. So, although Sanders had no affiliation with the Socialist Party, so. Is it a matter of reviving the positive aspects of socialism in this country as part of our history?
I don't think the labels help all that much. But what is important is to remember that there's been a long tradition in this country, and it's a growing tradition, of concern about safety nets, of social insurance, of protecting the losers, of protecting people whose, for no fault of their own, get caught in the downdrafts of an economy that it can be very, very fickle, and also to understand that the mythology we have of an American meritocracy is being challenged. We now have a large and growing group of people in this country who are called working poor. That should be an oxymoron. If you're working, you should not be poor. We also have a significant number of people, not nearly as many, but they are growing in number, who are non-working rich. They are rich because their parents are rich, and they are receiving huge amounts of money. Well, both these groups, the working poor and the non-working rich, really are inconsistent in some very profound way with the American notion of meritocracy. I've encountered so many people, Leonard, over the last few years, who are working very hard, not getting getting ahead, barely making it, or not making it at all, and who blame themselves, who say, well, I must be stupid, or I must be incapable because I'm not doing it. They need to understand that it is not so much them, it is a system that is no longer working for them, or no longer giving them the opportunities that somebody in their position used to have. When, for example, we used to have a third of our private sector workforce in unions. I also come across, from time to time, very wealthy people who assume that they must be extraordinarily smart, clever, gifted, because they're so wealthy, without acknowledging that it is so much now a matter of your luck in the parents you happen to have, or the contacts you happen to make, or whether you're positioned at exactly the right time at the right place in terms of this very, very arbitrary economy. So meritocracy is something that we've got to understand is a fleeting and, in very many profound ways, mythological concept.
The Obama fundraising methods changed the way campaigns were being funded. Everybody said it was going to change them for the future. And now we have further changes with Sanders' fundraising ability. Do you think that that's the wave of the future for the Democrats?
I'm not sure it's the wave of the future for the Democrats, but I think that one of the many legacies of Bernie Sanders is to rebut the assumption that we kept hearing from Democrats and from Republicans, but mostly from Democrats, who said, well, I believe in campaign finance reform, but I am not going to campaign with one hand tied behind my back. I'm not going to fail to get big money because my opponents in the Republican Party are doing it. I think Bernie showed that it is possible to wage an extraordinary campaign and accumulate plenty of money for the purposes of putting on ads and doing whatever else a campaign needs to do through small funders, through small donations. But you can only get that scale of small donations if you stand for something, if people believe you and believe your message and get mobilized, excited, energized, enthusiastic about what you represent.
How about the down ballot? Do you think that there'll be more Sanders-esque candidates for Congress in the future?
I certainly do. And I think that that may prove to be one of the most enduring aspects of his campaign. I hope that the movement that he has so skillfully accelerated, it was already there, I mean, but he helped generate even more of that movement. I hope it does focus not only this time around in this election cycle, but also in 2018 and in 2020 on promising candidates at the Senate, congressional, down ticket at the gubernatorial and even state Senate levels and state assembly levels, where you've got many, many people who might be willing to get into politics and have the right values, but are scared off by the prospect of, you know, you have to have a lot of money or you have to play the game exactly the way politicians have always played it. Bernie Sanders shows that's not necessary. I think his legacy is a walking invitation, an open invitation to many people to get into politics for the right reasons.
Do you think that the recent court decisions regarding voter ID laws in many states will have an impact on the upcoming local and congressional elections?
I do, particularly not just North Carolina and Wisconsin, although those
just had North Dakota today, I think.
I didn't know about that. Well, I think that what we're finding is that, perhaps not surprisingly, the federal courts are looking at these voter ID restrictions, all sorts of other. It's not just voter ID. And they're finding that they are very, very thin guises for racial discrimination. And even though the Supreme Court threw out very much of the Voting Rights Act, unfortunately, in that Holder decision, Shelby decision, still the lower courts are very activist and are protecting the interests of racial minorities. I think that it's going to have a very significant impact, again, particularly in places like North Carolina and Wisconsin, which are swing states.
Do you think that we pay enough attention to people who run for office and lose, the candidates that represent the people who don't get what they want?
Well, well, you're doing a good job in this series focusing on some of the losers. I don't know if you happen to focus on Teddy Roosevelt in 1912.
Yeah, you cited Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Delano Roosevelt as the last two times that platforms were followed. Do we need another Roosevelt to run for president to get a platform appreciated?
I don't know. But that 1912, I was just this morning looking at Teddy Roosevelt's 1912, a Bull Moose campaign platform, which I believe is still the most radical and most inspiring platform to have come along, certainly since 1912. And it had in it almost every aspect of what became Franklin D. Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's fifth cousin, his New Deal. It presaged the New Deal, and it was it's an amazing document.
Now, probably many people are predicting anyway. Donald Trump will be the also-ran in this election, although we can't be sure. But what if Hillary Clinton does win? What effect do you think Donald Trump's campaign will have on American politics in the long run?
Well, I have some fears about it, Leonard. I think the Republican Party has a chance of becoming the authoritarian party. Donald Trump could change the Republican Party forever because they're really, when you look at parties today, there really is nothing there, as Gertrude Stein once said about Oakland, California. There's really just a fundraising machine. I mean, the Democratic Party and the Republican parties are really giant fundraising machines. They are not really, they don't stand for much in and of themselves. And so when you have somebody like Donald Trump coming along and taking over, essentially taking over a party, he is taking it over not just as a fundraising machine, but Donald Trump is actually giving the Republican Party something it has not had. And unfortunately, he's giving it the worst possible meaning and content you can imagine. And he may be changing that Republican Party for years to come. The other worry I have about his legacy, assuming he loses, please God, is that he legitimizes a kind of a bigotry and hate speech in this country that was almost being legitimized through Fox News and through Rush Limbaugh and certainly on the internet, the vitriol on the internet. But we haven't seen it in a presidential contest until Donald Trump. I hope he hasn't. I worry that that kind of derogatory, hateful, and really negative, divisive rhetoric is now something that people say, well, if a presidential candidate can use it, I certainly can use it.
DNC CEO Amy Dacey resigned today. She's the first senior aide to depart after Debbie Wasserman Schultz. So do you think the party's going to be moving in another direction?
Well, I certainly hope so. I've been, you know, in every way I know and to do it, I've been signaling to the Democratic Party that they have got to clean up their act. I mean, even if they are continuing to be a fundraising machine, they cannot continue to play favorites. They've got to be neutral arbiters. They've got to maintain public trust. And I think that what's happened is that and this was even before the leaks. You know, people blame the leaks. Well, this is even before the leaks. A lot of Bernie Sanders supporters felt with some justification that the DNC was favoring Hillary Clinton. And it was a kind of a microcosm of the rigging and the rot in our system. And I think that the Democratic National Committee has got to go overboard, to get rid of superdelegates, make sure that the primaries are going to be open to independent voters as well as Democrats, and also you know, make an example of what voting minimum voting standards can be across the country in terms of primaries and caucuses.
Just one more thing. Have you ever considered running for office?
Well, yes, I did actually run in the Democratic primary for governor of Massachusetts in 2001.
Oh, so you're an also-ran. Oh,
I'm an also-ran.
How appropriate to have you on the series.
Yes, I'm surprised you didn't even think of me, Leonard. I am very much of an also-ran, and I found that running for office, particularly, in that case it was a governor's office, is much harder than it looks. I mean, I had been around politicians for years, and I thought, well, you know, I can do this. Not only do you have to have nerves of steel and a thick hide, but you also have got to be able to have the stamina of a 20-year-old, and I don't.
Thank you so much for being on this series for us. It's always a pleasure having you on our show, Robert Reich. We've been talking about Bernie Sanders in the last installment of Also-Ran's A Look at American Losers.
Thank you, Leonard.
Yes, folks, this isn't any cheap X-rated movie or any fifth-rate porno play. This is the show you want. Lady Divine's Cavalcade of Perversions, the sleaziest show on earth. Not actors, not paid imposters, but real, actual filth who have been carefully screened in order to present to you the most flagrant violation of natural law known to man.
John Waters is known mostly for his absurdist comedies, often done on purpose in the very worst of taste. His second feature film, Multiple Maniacs, provided a fair share of shocks, with Mr. Waters' iconic star Divine playing the leader of a traveling freak show called The Cavalcade of Perversions. A new restoration of the 1970 film opens tomorrow at the IFC Center, and I'm pleased that it has brought John Waters back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you. I never thought I would be back here with a movie I made almost 50 years ago, but it's kind of hilarious and great.
Some directors don't like looking at their early works, but you wrote in your memoir, Shock Value, that Multiple Maniacs is your favorite of all your films.
Well, I wrote that in 1980. I made a lot of movies since then. I
always thought it was the new one that people love. My latest baby is always the
best. No, I think Serial Moms may be the best movie I've ever made if you look at it from every viewpoint. But Multiple Maniacs is one that is now, I think, the reviews so far have been great. And they were all horrible then. It's because you're seeing this weird movie in a time capsule. And you even see a calendar in the background that says 1969 in it, so when we shot it. So basically, to see it today in this kind of political climate, when it was a movie made to offend hippies in a good way, because we were kind of yippies, so it was kind of making fun of it. But that's who came. My audience was definitely people that wanted to have their sensibilities flailed a little bit.
You not only directed Multiple Maniacs, you also produced, wrote, and edited it. Were you involved in the restoration?
Yes, I was. And I think, Criterion came to me with Genesis, the theatrical release, and it was so great to me because all the first art films from Bergman I saw were from Janus Films. And Criterion, they really had the right idea, because we first talked about, do you want to restore it with all the mistakes like it originally was to keep the flavor, or do you want to make it look as good as we can possibly do? And then I saw what they could do. I said, are you kidding? I never wanted those mistakes. This is what I wanted it to look like then, only didn't know how to do it. So it seems new today. It's a different ratio. I said in the press release, it finally looks like a bad John Cassavetes movie.
But you still have actors flubbing their lines.
Yeah, well, sort of flubbing. Yeah. Well, they have to memorize 4 pages of dialogue in one scene because we filmed with a single system camera where the sound was right on the film, so you couldn't cover a scene like you do today.
And you had very long takes.
Well, you had to, because the sound was 24 frames ahead of the picture. You had to overlap that 24 frames on every cut. So not like today where you shoot a scene from 5 different angles and you edit together. There was no negative. This is reversal film. It was before video, and it's what all news teams use to shoot the news.
Why did you take on all the different roles? Could you have gotten some other people, for example, to do the camera work or to do the
editing? Well, I should have. It would have been better, as I learned later. But no.
It was that low budget?
Yeah, it cost $5,000, the whole movie. And most of that was for the tent rentals for the Cavalcade of Perversion and the Roman soldiers outfit for the Stations of the Cross.
It contains a lot of nudity, some crass behavior.
Not much nudity.
Okay, some nudity.
Yeah.
Crass behavior, yes.
Lots
language,
of that.
A few things I don't even want to talk about on the air. Did you have any issues getting it screened originally?
Oh, of course. You know, are you kidding? It never had real distribution. I went around the country with it and opened it in churches, oddly enough.
Churches?
Yeah, because you forget. You know, you might remember. Remember Judson Memorial Church? Mm-hmm. All the churches had left-wing things in the 60s, anti-war movements. The Black Panthers couldn't meet there. So they would always say yes to me. They didn't see the movies. They figure anything to get his friends in a church. Believe me, this is the only way they're ever going to be in there. And they would freak out a little when they saw the movie, especially Multiple Maniacs, because it has a scene that's pretty sacrilegious.
There's a scene that takes place in a church. Yes. How did you get permission to shoot in a church, or did you just shoot?
No, we knew the priest, but he didn't know what we shot, and we had somebody back there talking to him about ending the war in Vietnam and stuff while we shot the scene, and then he came to the opening and started practically crying when he saw the scene. I said, I swear to you, I'll never tell where we shot it, and I never have to this day.
Is it strange now to see the film being screened at a major venue like the IFC Center?
Well, the IFC is home to me. That's where Hairspray opened, yeah. My original Hairspray. The last time I appeared ever in person with Divine was there. So it's kind of home for me. I'm really happy it's going to be there.
Considering its early history, I assume most of our listeners aren't acquainted with the film. Can you give us a sense of what Multiple Maniacs is about?
Well, it's a melodrama.
That the FCC will not object to.
No, yeah, I know. It's about a touring group, the Cavalcade of Perversions, that lures suburbanites in to see things that would shock their sensibility, and then they murder and rob them. And then they're on the scape, and it's involved a melodrama about divorce, and then Divine is going crazier and crazier, and she's raped by a lobster. And it's a monster movie. Mm-hmm. It's Divine was my Godzilla. And I always said Divine was not transgendered. Divine wanted to be Gorgo, not a woman.
Divine wanted to be not even a drag queen. She wanted.
He was a drag. Divine. He was a fat person. He was too hot wearing those wigs and stuff. He did it when he was paid to, when he was in movies and when he did his recording career. But he never just walked around in drag ever in his whole life.
Her boyfriend lures housewives and their husbands into this freak show where they're appalled by what they see. And,
yeah, but
and they're made fun of. But won't most moviegoers be appalled by a couple of things in that show too?
Well, licking a bicycle seat—that's not that bad these days. That's kind of almost whimsical.
Mm. Okay, where did you get the original idea for doing it as a freak show?
Well, I always wanted to make exploitation films for art theaters. And when I was a kid, I went to the Timonium Fair, which is the same place Diane Arbus took some of those sideshow photos. And they had a freak show. And I went every year. And they had a special tent at the end where you had to pay more to go in. And that's sort of what happens here. And then you get robbed and murdered. Mm. But it was from going to real freak shows. And I would go see the fat lady. And she had a special tent. And she's just sitting there on a folding chair in a polka dot dress with bees around. There's always bees at state fairs. And most people would walk and be so uptight they would just leave because it was just you and her sitting there. But I stayed and I stared and she glared at me. And it sort of gave me this real thrill of show business.
I got the feeling that monster in that 15-foot lobster scene, it reminded me of William Castle's The Tingler.
Well, I wasn't thinking at the time, but The Tingler was a huge influence. I have a replica of The Tingler on my mantle in my living room in Baltimore right today. It was made by Vincent Perenia, the first production designer for all my movies. He went on, he did The Wire, Homicide, done a million great movies and shows. He made it, but you can see his legs. He and his brother are in it. You can see his legs.
Didn't you also make a Smell-O-Vision movie once?
Yes, called Polyester. That was later, yes, and it came with an Odorama card.
Did you feel like you were something of a freak when you were growing up in suburban Maryland?
Well, when I was growing up, the word freak was good. It meant, you know, like hippie, crazy, on pothead, that kind of thing. So, yes, I was proud to be one, except I didn't feel... I knew I never fitted in from the very beginning, but that was not really traumatic for me because I wanted bohemia. I read about bohemia in Life magazine when I was maybe 8 years old, and I knew that's what I wanted.
But was there much bohemia
no,
in Baltimore?
No, that was a problem. You had to really look for it when Lutherville, Maryland. Well, I did go downtown eventually, and there was a beatnik bar called Mardix. And my parents, I have to give them credit at the end, my mother would drive me down there and drop me off in the alley outside, and she said, maybe you'll find people you want here. Maybe you can find something.
Well, you ran your Dreamland Studios from your bedroom, and some of the sequences are shot in your parents' backyard. Did they know what you were doing?
No, they didn't want to know. My parents learned a long time ago not to snoop, because they did in the beginning, and they found stuff that was worse than they ever imagined. So they stopped snooping. No, they. My mother met Divine that day when we were filming the Cavalcade of Version, and Divine was dressed in a one-piece woman's white bathing suit covered in fake blood, carrying an axe. And he made it worse, though. He was so uptight, he took his wig off. So it was basically a man in a woman, and my mother just served us tea and tried to be polite.
But they obviously were loving. They funded your early movies.
Yeah, I paid them back. They were, yes, in hindsight, they were incredibly loving, because everything I did, no one said it was good then. And they were humiliated by the reviews, were like really hostile. And the neighbors were horrified. There's a scene where Divine, like, just carrying an axe, like, looks in a neighbor's window. I didn't even ask the neighbor. She could have been having her Sunday morning breakfast and look up from the table, and there's Divine snarling at her through her front window. Yes, they were very, because they realized that no matter what, I had this career I was doing, even when I was very young, and what else could I do? I think they just figured, we better cut our losses here.
Well, did they live long enough to see you succeed?
Oh, yes, completely they did. My parents' happiest night when first night of Hairspray on Broadway. Oh, yeah, they were completely proud and everything. But my father did say after he saw my last movie, it was funny. I hope I never see it again. So to this day, they did teach me humor in a real way, too. And they taught me the tyranny of good taste is how I was raised. And that's how I knew the rules to break them.
My guest is John Waters, who directed, produced, edited, and wrote Multiple Maniacs, which is opening at the IFC Center tomorrow. Divine starred in most of your movies until he died in 1988?
He died 2 weeks after Hairspray opened. Yep.
How did the two of you meet?
We met. He moved with his parents that, oddly enough, ran a children's nursery school, and he was their only child, maybe not the best ad for that. They moved about six houses away from my parents when we were in high school.
How much of your success do you think you owe to Divine?
Certainly a lot in the beginning, because I made Divine vehicles. It was like Susan Hayward pictures. Mm-hmm. I wrote movies for Divine. And Divine didn't write them. And in the beginning, he would say, should I say this stuff? I mean, he was even like nervous to say it. But then eventually he got used to it and liked it and could say my lines just in such a wonderful way.
The cast and crew that you repeatedly use in your films were called Dreamlanders. How important was it for you to build a good rapport with the people that you worked with?
Certainly, I'm still friends with them. Mink Stole just came and visited me in Provincetown last
week. Mink
Stole
worked as a techie and also appeared in the
films.
Well,
she worked behind the scenes, yeah, but she mostly was the actress in it. Divine killed her in every movie I ever made, practically.
She was Divine's lover in this film.
And, yes, an enemy, though, at the end. But, yes, Mink and I have been friends for 50 years. Pat Moran, who casts all my movies, has won Emmys since and everything. She casts everything. So I think it's very important to have friends your whole life.
Some Dreamlanders, like Edith Massey, you just found on the street of Baltimore.
Well, I found her in the bar in Multiple Maniacs where she actually works, Pete's Hotel. That's filmed where I actually met her. She worked there for real.
Did most of them share your sensibility? Did they enjoy doing this kind of thing and shocking?
Yes, I think Edith said, I like what comes afterwards. I hate doing it while we make it. But everybody else, yes, it was group madness. It was shared. It was like a political cell.
And a shared aesthetic.
Yes.
But then you mellowed a bit with films like Hairspray.
Oh, my last movie got an NC-17, lost the appeal with the censor board, and was about sex addicts taking over a neighborhood. I don't think I think I ended my movie career right where I began it. Trouble.
But you haven't made a film in 10 years.
Well, that's why.
Is that it? Your parents aren't willing to fund you anymore?
No, they didn't fund me. The studios did. But what happens? The last two movies didn't make money. My last two books were on the bestseller list, so I write books now. I signed a two-book deal for now. But I had, since then, three development deals in the last decade, the movies that didn't happen, but Hollywood paid me to write them.
But even with something like Hairspray, you featured a confident fat girl, and although you've been quite thin all of your life. What draws you to overweight women or men in drag playing fat women?
Well, I've had good luck with ample women, as we call them. I think it started with Divine, certainly, who was a the opposite of what most female impersonators or drag queens look like then, and I think he changed drag forever. He made them all edgy and confrontational. And then it went to Ricky Lake because I thought putting a fat girl as the star, she's never the star. She's usually this wisecracking sidekick. So she gets the guy, everything. She stood for every outsider ever. But when Divine died, I never did that again. I couldn't replace Divine, so I hired Johnny Depp.
Well, you were in Baltimore. Every one of your films was shot in Baltimore.
Yeah.
So somebody like Ricky Lake would find you?
We find her. We're regular casting agents in New York. And they were cast conventionally
later. Because she was terrific.
Yeah, she was great. Are you kidding? She's introducing me tomorrow night in Fire Island when I do my show.
And how did you find Johnny Depp? Again, casting agent?
Johnny Depp was at the time a huge... He was Justin Bieber. He was the hugest TV star for 21 Jump Street. He was a teen idol. And he hated being a teen idol, so... Stick with us or kill that. And we did in a good way, because after he made Crybaby, he was in Edward Scissorhands. So Johnny's had a great career.
He's getting bad publicity recently. Maybe that means you could do another film with him.
No, I love Johnny. Here's all I know about that is I was with him in the days when he was drunk and crazy, and he was always a gentleman to all women when I was around him.
Meanwhile, we have this film, Multiple Maniacs, which will be... opening tomorrow at the IFC Center. How long is it running?
Well, we'll see. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
And you're not doing any live appearances?
No, there. I'm introducing the film tomorrow night and answering questions, yeah.
The problem is it's sold out.
Yes, that's not a problem to me.
No, but reasons I was almost reluctant to mention it because I don't want anybody to be disappointed.
Well, it's playing there the rest of, it's in a run. It's just those two shows opening night, but you can certainly see it, and you don't really need me. The film will deliver, I hope.
John Waters, it's always a pleasure having you on
our
show.
Thank you for having me again.
So write more books and make another movie.
I will, hopefully.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.